this working?
Pardon me? No, I got some kind of something here. I think it's gin.
Hey, I'm Cersei and I'm an alcoholic. But by the grace of God and help from people like you, Al-Anon, Valentine, Valitot, Valitors, and I've been helped by everybody that had anything to do with an alcoholic or ever wanted to have anything to do. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be anywhere. Hell, at my age, I don't even buy green bananas. But I'm damn glad to get it, I'll tell you that. Some people don't like to have birthdays. I do. I've got three important numbers in my life. 91, 67, 55. I'm 91 years old. I've been married to the same woman 67 years, and I've been sober 55 years. How's that? Well, I'm not going to do a drunkalogue. I know you hope that. But I have to tell you a little bit about how I was raised and these things, how they came. And let's talk a little about history and how these things happened. And mainly, I want you to remember, as I do, that all of this is because of the hand of a power greater than ourselves. The bottom line is we have to have the power greater than ourselves. How do we know AA? We wouldn't have AA if it weren't. The first 100 members of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill Wilson told me this for sure. 25 of them were agnostic. They didn't believe in God. And they met and met and met, and they all admitted we're powerless over alcohol. Our lives are unmanageable. No problem. Everyone agreed to that. But where do we go from here? And they said, well, go to each other. We've tried that. Have to do that and the other and this and that. And it worked. It didn't work. So what happened? They came to believe in a power greater than themselves. Could restore them to sanity. Well, I was born on a farm down in West Texas. And sorry damn farm. I never saw a good one. But there were 7 in my family. And we were dirt farmers, and we had to work, and I had to chop cotton and pick cotton, in which I hated every damn minute of it. And so I left that farm on account of my belief. I got to believe in other people's hogs were mine. And I had an old aunt up at Stamford, Texas. I'm getting up in the big cities now, probably 1,400 people there. And finished high school, and when I finished high school, I had a job, a contract to play semi-pro baseball in the old West Texas League. And we had good baseball players that came out there, and these big oil companies would sponsor baseball teams. They'd pay them big salaries and to play baseball and do nothing during the week. They acted like they were doing something, but they weren't. They gave me a job with a big motor company. And I played baseball. I pitched baseball on weekends, and then I'd work for this motor company on the 4 days a week. So I don't know about you. I never liked to drink with a sorry drinker, somebody that couldn't drink, you know, a whole bunch and puke it up and drink some more and just keep on, you know. That was my type of drinking. In our baseball team, we had a guy named Red Hill, played third base. And he was a sorry drinker. He'd drink a few beers and just pass out, you know. That to we who could handle it so well, that was degrading, you know. But anyhow, our baseball manager was a guy named Doc Ellis. And Doc had a funeral parlor. And every Sunday after the ball game, we'd meet at the funeral parlor and drink beer, home brew. Many of you don't know what homebrew was or is. It's macaroni and cheese and stuff fermented that make you drunk. That's all I know about it.
this night, having, I'm sure, lost the ball game, we were acting silly and drinking and at the funeral home. And Red Hill had a couple of beers and passed out on the floor. And we who could handle it so well were terribly disappointed in him. And so we picked him up and put him in a casket. And we stood back to listen to what his reaction would be if he waked up. And finally he did wake up, and he reached around on his side and front and felt around and the side of the casket and all. And then we heard him say, "Well, if I'm not dead, why am I here? And if I am dead, why do I have to go to the bathroom?" I think Red joined our group later on, don't you? I think he's a good candidate. Well, we talk about these things. I was not born an alcoholic, and as far as I'm concerned, nobody is. Some of us are born with the X factor in our lives, and if we add alcohol to it in large doses over a period of time, we cross the line into compulsive pathological drinking, and that's the only kind of drinking that's a disease. Just a Saturday night get drunk is not an alcoholic necessarily. But anyhow, I had that X factor evidently. My father and mother never took a drink in their lives. But I had two brothers in AA. One of them 20 years sober when he died, one of them 30 years sober when he died. But I was raised a Baptist, and I'm a recovering Baptist. Well, after I finished high school and went up there and played baseball a while, and then they hired me in this motor company to be general manager, and it was a big corporation, and we did real well. We had Dodge trucks. And I was in a sandstorm country out there, and there was sandstorm would come, and the sand would get in the motors of the cars and trucks and just burn them up. So Dodge put an oil filter on, and we sold the hell out of those Dodge trucks to everybody, you know. And it was a real good deal. We made a lot of money. So my drinking increased and increased and increased, and I had to do a lot of entertaining. I don't know about y'all, you know, I had a carload of whiskey around everything. You have to entertain your customers if you want to get business, you know. Not that you need the alcohol, but, you know. So, somewhere along the line, I crossed that line into compulsive pathological drinking. Drinking for a different reason. Drinking to get away from the effects of drinking. So what do you do? Well, I took the geographical cure. A geographical cure, that's unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. And the further you go with uncontrolled drinking, the worse it gets. You can't imagine, well, I used to could drink and go to work and this and that, and everything was fine, and now I can't go to work, I can't do anything, and have lost my self-esteem. What happened? So you get on those four horses. I did terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And I rode those horses to death. You don't mind if I sit down, do you? I can talk better sitting down. Is that all right? So I rode those horses, and I kept the pattern of drinking was worse and worse and worse and worse. And so I went off to, on a geographical cure, I went off down to Corpus Christi, Texas. They hired me as credit manager of the Packard Motor Company. And there may be a Packard man. There's not very many of them left. A few of them around. There's a big old long car, and they're sorry as hell. They weren't any good, you know. But I'd load that car with booze and go out on the King Ranch. And it was a great big ranch. Nothing out there but cattle and rattlesnakes. And I'd go out there and stay a week and drink booze. But I was on a strict diet, cheese and crackers. And I'd come in, the inquisitive, the narrow-minded employers. You ever notice that? They won't know where in the hell you've been. It's none of their business. They're just paying you, you know. And, well, finally my self-esteem was gone, and I just didn't care what happened. So I hired out to a guy that had some pickle trucks, and they serviced hamburger joints. And I didn't want anybody to see me, a CEO, a big shot like me, driving a pickle truck. Can you imagine such a thing? But I did. Anyhow, one day another drunk and I got in the truck, and we went to a stop. Our first stop was a hamburger joint. And if you think it's not a problem to try to handle gallon jars of pickles and onions and try to balance yourself drunk, try it sometime. And we got to this hamburger joint, and the guy said, "This is a holiday. Didn't you know that?" And I said, "No, but I'm damn glad of it." And so we went to Mexico for a vacation. And while down there drinking, I made a deal with this guy that had the bar. I traded a load of pickles and onions for booze. No boot, no difference. We traded even. And we got in the truck and went back to Corpus Christi and checked in the New Aces Hotel, which is a fine, and we checked in the Presidential Suite. I have you. Neither one of us had a nickel. But we were in that big hotel. And, my wife was a court reporter out in West Texas. And she had worked in the county judge's office for years, and she did court reporting. If it hadn't been for her making money, we'd have starved to death during some of my drinking years. But anyhow, I had promised her if she'd come to Corpus Christi and join me, I would slow down on my drinking. I would get it under control, you know. And all those kind of promises, and so she came down. She joined me. And she could have worked for 400 lawyers in Corpus Christi. She worked for the one that represented the guy that owned the pickle truck that I ran off with. Now, you think your luck's not shot to hell when you get to where you can't drink. You work for narrow-minded employers and people that don't appreciate you and stuff like that. Long story short, my brother got me out of that jam, and I moved to Dallas. And I went to work for a company that built Grumman bomb doors for airplanes during the war, World War II. This is not the Revolutionary War. And you know, alcoholics can spot phonies. And they had me in charge of time study out there. I studied everybody's time to see if they were doing things so we'd win the war. And I observed that some of those people were not doing their job, so I volunteered to go into service and win the war. And I did. They surprised me. They took me. And I stayed in there about a year, and they decided if they're going to win the war, they better get rid of me, and that's what they did. I went back to Dallas, and the day I got back, I went to work for a company I'd done business with before. They moved me out to Lubbock, Texas, and in charge of 5 states. And I traveled out on a day in Odessa, Texas, which was about 100 miles from Lubbock. I ran into an old drinking buddy of mine in front of the hotel where we were staying. Well, first, the guy's car broke down that I was traveling with. And I said, "You fix the car, get it fixed, and I'll walk back to the hotel. I'm no dummy." There was a liquor store between there and the hotel. And so when I ran into Bob Skimmerhorn, an old drinking buddy of mine, his family were rich. They had a lot of money, oil companies, and he and I drank together, but he's a sorry drinker. He had always had a pocket full of money. He'd drink, pass out, and I'd steal his money. He kept me drunk for years. So, I asked him, "Let's go have a drink. And I'm about to die." And he said, "I'll go with you." And we got up there, and I poured him a drink, poured me a drink, said, "You take your drink, you need it, but I'm not drinking today."
So I queried him about what kind of venereal disease he had. He wasn't drinking. And he said, well, here's what happened. He said, you know, I haven't been able to handle alcohol in a long time. I said, I knew that. I knew you were a sorry drinker. But he said, I would get up and drive at night with a carload of liquor. And I ran into a carload of ladies out near the airport, and three of them were killed. And you can imagine the anguish my mother and I have had having killed people drunk. And he said, I found a group of guys called Alcoholics Anonymous in Dallas. He'd moved to Dallas. And he said, we just don't drink a day at a time. And he said, I've been sober 10 months. Then I knew he was lying, you know. And but anyhow, we talked a while, and he said, I'm going to send you the big book, he called it. I didn't know the big book from Sears catalog, you know. And he sent it, but I told him to be careful not send it to my home. My wife might think I had a drinking problem, you know. And he sent it to my hotel where I'd be the next week. And I thumbed through that book 50 times. And you thumb through a book, keep thumbing through, you don't read it, you'll stay drunk. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. It didn't do a bit of good, so I took it home and hid it from my wife, I thought. But she found it, read it, and put it back. But she knew, said, that'll be fine, that's a good thing, but he'll never do it. So I got fired from that job in November of that year, and I stayed drunk from November until April of 1946. And then I went looking for Bob in Dallas. And I found Bob, and he put me in a drying out place, and I dried out for three or four days. And he said, I'm going to take you to AA. So we went downtown Dallas, 912 and a half Main Street, and parked in front of a liquor store. And then I knew AA had worked. But we didn't go in the liquor store. We went and climbed up some stairs. There were 12 people up there. And they were having fun. Bob was one of them. And they were enjoying each other, and by the grace of God, let me tell you what. Every single one of you persons here tonight are the only one that can make a difference in somebody's life. Nobody else can do it, but you. So this one guy that I know made the difference in my life was, he took me to the board and showed me the 12 steps. And he said, this is a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is how you can stay sober. If you admit you're powerless over alcohol, your life's unmanageable, I have no problem with that. Do you believe in the power greater than yourself? Yes, I do. Well, he said, I don't want your promises or propositions or your New Year's resolution. I want a commitment from you before you get out of bed every morning that you will not take a drink, just today. And he said, if you don't drink today, you never will drink. That's a slick way of doing it, because the next day is tomorrow, and I thought, well, this is today, I can't drink. And I've been dumb enough to do it every day since then. You know. I lived in Lubbock, Texas. There was not a group between Fort Worth and Phoenix, 1,200 miles. And not a group of AA. So I went out, I was a lone guy, went out to Lubbock. And, once a month, I'd go to Dallas to a meeting, whether I needed to meet or not, I'd just go in. Yeah. And, so we worked together fine, and we got a little group started, and we started going all the time, starting groups, and AA mushroom, but in 46 in November, Bill Wilson and Lois came to Austin, Texas, the capital, and for the first time, and I met Bill and Lois. And we developed a friendship that lasted until 1971 and when he died. And I don't mean just a friendship. We were together. My wife and his wife worked on the Al-Anon program. Incidentally, my wife's the oldest living Al-Anon in the world. She and Lois would get, when we'd go to their home visit, Stepping Stones, And here and there we'd make trips together, and we were real close associated for all those years. I don't know why I was that lucky, but I was. And so, over the course of the period of time, I was inquisitive as hell. I wanted to know about how Bill's spiritual experience happened, how all these things happened. I sincerely wanted to know because I thought it was necessary. It was not, but I thought it was. And so Bill asked me one day, he said, "You're so damned inquisitive about it. Why don't you go to the Yale School and study alcoholism? And maybe you can learn some and then answer the questions you're trying to ask me to answer." And I said, "I'll go. How do I go?" He said, "I'll send you." He was damn glad to get rid of me. So I went up there old knowledgeable me, in 6 weeks, I learned everything it was to know. I learned it all. And, you know, somebody that goes from jail to Yale, that's pretty good. You're pretty smart. And so I came back to West Texas to spread the news and to pull people out of bars and sober up the whole world. And instead of that, I was spreading a disease, you know. So, in 1948, Bill Wilson came to West Texas. We had gotten 25 or 30 people in Lubbock to meet and talk about our problem. And Bill called me from out in Arizona where he visited his mother and said, "Meet me in Amarillo and I'll come down to your little meeting." And he and Lois came to Amarillo and I met them there. And we got on a plane and to go on to Lubbock, about 125 miles. And he reached in his pocket and pulled out some handwritten notes. And he said, "I want you to read these and see what you think about them and then let me have them back." Well, I read them over carefully, and knowledgeable me, you know. I said, "We don't need these, Bill. We love each other down here. Oh, God, do we love each other. We'll never have any problems, and we don't need anybody to tell us what to do." And it was the 12 traditions he had written down. "Aren't you glad I didn't start this thing?" Oof. But that was the beginning of a relationship with Bill, and in the meantime, he convinced me thoroughly and totally, completely, that we had to have the 12 traditions in order to survive. And so in 1950, I had found out all this real information on it at the first international conference in Cleveland. Bill and Dr. Bob got me up in the room, schooled me on how to get votes. We were going to vote on whether to accept or reject the 12 traditions at 2:45 that afternoon. Well, they buttonholed me. I got down to buttonhole people down on the floor to vote for this thing. We had to have it to save AA. Dr. Bob talked, Bill talked, and then we voted. And there was not a dissenting vote against the 12 traditions adopting them. Most of them didn't know what the hell they were voting on, but we voted to have the 12 traditions to save AA, the very thing that saved us. So, in the process of all this information I had, having gone to the Yale School, we talked Dr. Jelinek, who was a scientist, a banana scientist from South America, and he went up to Yale to head the Yale School on alcohol studies. And I asked him, we called him Bunky, we who worked with him, and I said, "Bunky, how in the hell does a scientist go from bananas to alcoholics?" Well, he said, "That's simple. They're just alike. They get away from the bunch, they get peeled." And so, later on, in about a year, they moved the Yale School to TCU at Fort Worth. And they hired another guy and I to do educational work. We set up local committees for education on alcoholism. And we did a good job. We had most every city in that area had a committee on alcoholism studies, and we had doctors and lawyers and everybody heading these committees up to help us to spread the word about the disease, alcoholism. And so anyhow, we did that for two or three years, and Dr. Jelinek, who was the head of the school, became ill. And he told me one day, he said, "Searchy, what we need is some medical hospitals where an alcoholic can go into and sober up and go into AA and stay sober." And I said, "Well, how do we do it?" And he said, "I'll help you set up some hospitals." So we set up a hospital in Lubbock first, and we got some prominent people to help us and to go on the Yale Plan Clinic. And then we put a clinic in Dallas, and Dr. Jelinek helped me do these things. And we had alcoholics coming from out of the woods. In those days, everybody was just pure alcoholics. It was not a drug problem then, the amount of things. And so these hospitals were a success in that people went directly. We had AAs in the clinics night and day, working with these people, sponsoring them, taking them to AA meetings, and 75% of them stayed sober. Not because of the hospital, because AA came in there and worked with them and took them and sponsored them and helped them. And maybe that's our problem today. We should never let a new person or a person who's having trouble leave our group without finding somebody that'll help them survive for the day and show them how they can do and how they can stay sober. So, in 1953, Bill Wilson called me and said, "I want to come see the hospital down there." And he came to Dallas, I took him over to the hospital, and he visited with every single person that was in that hospital sobering up. And then we went to lunch at a little place, a Melrose Hotel. And at that lunch, I asked Bill, I said, "You've seen a lot of things happen in Alcoholics Anonymous since 1935. What would you rather see happen now? This never happened." He, without hesitation, he said, "I'd rather see Abby have a chance to get sober." And so, I didn't know anything about Abby. Nobody down there knew anything. We never heard him mention, talk about him at all. But anyhow, when Bill looked at me and he said, "I wish you would try to help Abby." So we got on the phone and we called New York, and I talked to Bill about it. He said, "I wish you'd try to help Abby. Get him to this hospital some way." So we called New York. Charlie Milton was a guy that was in the essence business. And we knew Abby was on the Bowery down there and had been down there for years. But we didn't know, nobody knew where. So Charlie went to Paris, France that summer to an Essence convention, and there was a guy there that knew Abby and knew all about him, and he told him exactly where to find Abby on the Bowery. And Charlie came back and he located Abby down on the Bowery. Abby's life procession was an old Pan-American bag with all his clothes and everything he had in when he came to Dallas. But after he located Abby, he told him that what Bill had in mind for him, that there was a medical hospital in Dallas that he could go down and sober up and they'd take care of him. And he said, "Well, to hell with Bill and all those other people that are trying to get me to go sober up. I'm not going to do it." But anyhow, Charlie kept going back. He never gave up. Here's another thing let's learn along the way. Don't give up on anybody. Nobody is hopeless and helpless in this situation. Nobody. If you don't, look at the record. But Charlie kept going to the Abbey, and finally he made him promises. We'll get you a plane ticket. If you don't like it, we'll get a round trip, and you can go back if you don't like it. And so finally, Abbey propositioned him, "I'll get on that plane if you'll give me something to drink. I want a pint of liquor." And so he got him a pint of liquor and finally talked him into it. We got him on the phone. And he wanted to talk to us. Abby wanted to talk to us and Charlie down in Dallas. And this one guy, Olin Angister, was he did a lot of cursing. He a loud mouth guy and cussed a lot. And anyhow, we got it's on this tape over here. What Abby tells about it, that when we went to the Tri-State Convention in 1960. But on that conversation, we got Abby on there, and he heard this other guy, Ole, this guy that was loud mouthed and cussing. He said, "Send the Yankee son of a bitch on down here. We'll sober him up." And so they finally got him on the plane with a pint of liquor, and he came to Dallas. We met him at Love Field, the old airport there. And we started to leave out, show you how bad a condition he was in. We started to leave. Here was a sign out there that said, American Airlines to New York. And we're driving on. Abby said, "See there, we're still in New York. We haven't left New York yet." Well, anyhow, in the we put him in the clinic and gave him all kinds of the best medical treatments you could have. We had medical doctors that knew how to sober people up and the best way to do it. And so we assigned Abby. He had a room across from my office. And every morning he'd come in and cuss me out, and the next morning Bill Wilson, and the next day he'd cuss Dr. Bob out. And although he didn't know Dr. Bob, he'd cuss him out anyhow. And he was very bitter and very confused, and you can imagine 8 or 10 or 12 years on the Bowery with just drinking booze, what kind of condition you'd be in. Well, anyhow, this went on for about 5 or 6 weeks, and I called Bill Wilson, and I said, "We're not helping Abby. I can't help him. I can't get him to do anything." And but he was taking his medication. And so, anyhow, Bill said, "Keep trying. Keep trying. The last thing I want to do is see that Abby has a chance to get stay with him." And because of Bill Wilson, I did stay with him, and anyhow, about the same day or two, a nurse came in. She said, "I see a little improvement in Abby." And I said, "Well, I don't. Maybe you do, but I don't." And she said, "Well, let me work with him." And she was in AA, a registered nurse. And so I made a trip and came back a few days later, and she said, "I see a little improvement in AA, in Abby. He has a little different attitude." And I said, "Well, I'll have to see that." But after about a week, he came in to my office one day with a different attitude. Something had happened. And he said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going over to the club, the group." And he said, "What group is that?" And I said, hey, you know what." And he said, "Can I go with you?" "Sure." So he went over there, and we talked a while, and came back. And the next day, he went over and stayed all day at the clubhouse, the group. And about a week after then, he asked me where I was going. I said, "I'm going to Lubbock, Texas, and talk at a convention out there, a small convention ahead." And we went out there, and at this meeting that night, they had everybody introduce themselves. And Abby got up and said, "I'm Abby Thatcher, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm damn glad to be in AA and glad to be sober." So the first time there was a flicker, a light, that sunlight of the Spirit had shown in some way, somehow. Not because of me, but because not giving up on somebody and staying with the course, staying the course to try to help somebody, it finally began to pay off. So this history of how things if we look at the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, we'll see the threads of spirituality woven through all the fabric of AA, every bit of it. We do all these things, and we think we're doing a hell of a good job, and we're doing our best, and we're going on, but the bottom line is that power greater than we are has to intercede, and then it's successful. You ever notice that? It always happens. It's just like those first 100 members of AA. And they met, but they couldn't go any further than the first step until they came to believe in the power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. AA worked from the beginning. Nobody sat down and wrote the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. These 100 people did what it says, and they stayed sober. How do we know it worked? It worked from the beginning. So, if we look at the how this thing all happened is all by the grace of God. All by the grace of God. And so, Abby was a lesson to me to not give up, ever give up on anybody. No matter how long it takes or what you have to do, stay with them until they have a chance to get sober, until they can understand what we're talking about. So, Abby's brother, a couple of them, one of them at least came down to the clinic down in Dallas while Abby was there. And I've got a book back there full of correspondence about Abby through Bill Wilson and Ole Lancaster that Mel is acquainted with. But it has all the things that happened. And at one time, Abby, we were going to get him a job. There was some kind of a sanitation company that needed distributors. And so we were going to raise the money and put Abby as distributor, manager of that sanitation company. And we worked on that. But all the time, all this correspondence was coming from Bill. And the interest in Bill to make sure that Abby had a chance to stay sober. Well, Abby went out in West Texas on the ranch out there and worked. He'd never seen a horse or a cow, either one that I know of. But he went out there with Ralph Jones and his wife, and Ralph and his brother were members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he worked on that ranch. He hustled cattle, he rode horses, and all that stuff, and then worked. And he came back to Dallas, still sober. And he fell in love with a little nurse that worked for me a while. She'd worked for the county hospital. And she became addicted to drugs. And Abby fell in love with her, as he did most gals. And which is one of my problems, too. Not at my age. Well, anyhow, this lady, she was a nice lady, but she became very ill. And for 2 years, Abby nursed that lady night and day. Stayed with her. She was helpless. And he waited on her, and he stayed sober. And when she died, he got drunk. Whether that had anything to do, I don't know. And the lady asked a while ago, why didn't Abby stay sober? Who knows? I don't know why anybody doesn't stay sober, except that they never reach a point where they have a relationship with God, as we understand Him, or as they understand Him. And the only way I know that nobody ever is able to stay sober is because they're not willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety. So, Abby, we had a very good relationship after he got sober and after I gave up on him and then decided to stay with him. And we went to conventions together. We in 1954, Abby sobered up in 53 and 54. Bill Wilson came to the state convention in Fort Worth, Texas, and he had Abby up on the stage with him. And he always, like Mel said, Abby was always Bill's sponsor. You never gave up on him. Never. So there's a lesson for us, you know, not to give up on anybody, to stay with them. So there's a chance there of recovery. So, in 1955, we went to the International Conference in St. Louis, and Abby went with us, and he and Bill set up on the stage together, and Bill stayed with him all through thick and thin, all those things. And that's what a good pal, that's what sponsorship is. Gratitude in action. That's what sponsorship is. So, in 1960, I lived in Springfield, Illinois for a year. And they asked me to come speak at a tri-state conference in Illinois, Iowa, Wisconsin. It was in Davenport, Iowa. And they said, can you think Abby will talk for us? I said, I don't know. I'll try to get him. And he, I called him and he said, yeah, I'll meet you up there. And he came up in this Tri-State Communist, tape that he has over here. Abe talked for 45 minutes about his recovery and about what happened. And it's the only tape that he ever made where you know exactly what happened to him and how he felt about it. And I wish you could hear that tape, the lady that asked that question, why couldn't he get some? He talks about it in that tape. And there's proof of it. So, the lady that asked the question a while ago, is AA different today? AAs are not a damn bit different than when I came in 55 years old. But we're different. And we have different problems. And we are handling those problems as well as we could. AA is the same it's always been, but we changed. And we have different things we do. Hold hands, like Mel said. Even sponsorship. We didn't have sponsorship early. We didn't have sponsor each other very much. We call them helpers and people that helped us stay sober. But they were not, we didn't call them sponsors in the early days. And there's a lot of things that we have done over the years, and I have an open mind on all the things we do. And I'm not a bleeding deacon, I'll tell you that. Whatever it works, if it'll work, hold on to it. Do more of it. We talk about people that have dual addiction or triple addiction. You're damn right we have. But I see them, even people with nothing but drug addiction, I see them get well in AA with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I see them recover. So how am I to say it? You know, our third traditions, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And that goes for drugs or what else. And our movement. So I don't think nobody is no cast out in our fellowship. If the program works and it'll work for whatever's wrong with you, if it's alcohol or addiction or whatever it is, work it. And if you stay sober through it, that's good enough. And that's what you're for. That's what we're here for. So we have to carry this message to those who still suffer. And, I thought I had, you know, if you're not as close to God as you once were, make no mistake about who moved. And if you never were as close to God, make no mistake about who should move. And through the power greater than we are, and the miracles of God, are we allowed to live a full life, a complete life, a happy, sober, joyous, free life on a daily basis, by adhering to the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, the things that have happened, the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, is nothing short of a miracle of how God works in people's lives. It's what happens to us. It's what happens to other people too, but more so about, to the alcoholic, because nobody understood our illness or that it was an illness. They thought it was a moral problem. And it was with me, to an extent. but through the years, I've been to every one of the international conferences, 11 of them, every 5 years. And I see people here that I've met there, a whole bunch of you that I saw up there, last year at the internet in Minneapolis. And there's a guy and a gal that drove all the way from there. There he comes in the right down. Corey, stand up. He drove all the way down here from Minneapolis. How about that? Give him a hand. Michelle, over that you hold up. There. And but there, Peter and Connor drove all the way down here from Nashville. Stand up, will you, Peter and Connor? Here they are. There they are. The people, we go to any length to achieve sobriety. We go to any length to do what is necessary to stay happy, joyous, and free. And I told you I went to high school in Stamford, Texas. Small town, very small, but we had a guy in the, that finished school when I did, high school, that wrote a lot of songs. Most of them were religious songs or spiritual songs. And he went to Hollywood finally and wrote songs, all these religious movies, he wrote the songs for it. His name was Stuart Hamblin. His dad was a Methodist preacher, and that's the reason I didn't think much of him being a Baptist, you know. But he wrote a song that I told him, and incidentally he called me 2.5 years before he died and said he'd gone into AA and he was sober. And asked me to be his sponsor, and I said, you bet. But he wrote this one song, and I told him I thought he wrote it for us, for Alcoholics Anonymous. And the title of it is, if you remember, you probably heard it, it is no secret what God can do. And it goes like this, the chimes of time ring out the news another day is through. Someone slipped and fell. Was that someone you? You may have longed for added strength, your courage to renew. Do not be disheartened because I've got news for you. It is no secret what God can do. There is no night, for in his light you will never walk alone. You'll always feel at home, wherever you may roam. There is no power can conquer you while God is on your side. Just take him at his promise. Don't run away and hide. It is no secret what God can do. He wrote that old song at this old house and a bunch of those songs like that. But Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest thing that ever happened for we who are suffering alcoholics. And it did me. I've been sober 55 years, and there's no way that I could have stayed sober even a month. I couldn't imagine what the hell would you do if you didn't drink. That was my idea, you know. And I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been given the gift of sobriety for all those years. And happy sobriety, and the privilege of being very close personally to Bill and Lois, and we were for many years, all the years that before Bill died. So I learned a lot from him how to handle things. You hear these books that are written, stories that are written about the degradation to Bill and what. As far as I'm concerned, he's one of the powers that helped us to find God. And if you'll remember the part that Abby played in this and why he said he was his sponsor. Bill Wilson was in town's hospital for the 40th time, drunk. Old Abby came to see him. And Abby was sober in the Oxford group, like Mel was talking about. And Bill queried Abby, how, you're sober, what happened? And he told him a few things. He said, well, what do you do? What do you do? He said, we trust God, clean house, and help others. And we haven't improved on that a damn bit till today. It's still the bottom line. Trust God, clean house, and help others. So anyhow, Bill was agnostic. He got on his knees that very night, and he said, if there is a God, show himself to me. And he had that spiritual experience. The soft wind blew over him and all those things. A real spiritual experience. Now, I've had some hot flashes, but I think it's my age. But old Bill really had the spiritual awakening, right? Not an awakening, but an experience. And so that's the difference. Don't sit around. I've been sitting around 55 years to have a spiritual experience, and I'm still having those hot flashes. But the closer that I have my sobriety, my whole life, everything is contingent upon my relationship with God as of today. And whatever your opinion or idea of that higher power is, stick with it. And improve it by the 11th step, where we seek through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. I forget sometimes that a conscious contact with God is different. I'll be praying about something and thinking about a football game or something else, you know. Get off the track and forget what I'm trying to talk about or dream about. So it's imperative that I have a close conscious contact with that power as I understand him. And that's not necessarily a Baptist understanding either. I'll have you know that. So a lot of things happened in the history of AA, and I'm glad to have been a part of it. And I've seen a lot of things happen. But all the things that happen in AA, even the bad things, are a lesson to us. If everybody in here stayed sober and had no problem, we wouldn't have AA. But some fail, and some don't get it. Some have problems, some this and that and the other. But let's stay with those people. There is somebody, and one of you are the one that can help that somebody. Nobody else can touch them, but you can. So there's some other things we could talk about, and all these things that are some of these things. Even the story of Abby is in my book back there, and it's a history of AA, and the other book is a study book of the first 9 steps, 2 different methods. And I'm not in the book business, I'll tell you that. But if you want to see some of that history in there, that these happenings, the things that went on, how we developed, how we became more affluent in all the areas of the world. And if you look at the success of AA, we are a successful fellowship that helps a lot of people that are helpless otherwise. So I'll throw it open. Anybody got a question?
Hi, I'm Susan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Susan.
You said you knew a lot of the early people in AA. I'm wondering if you knew Marty Mann and what you thought of her. And I also had another question. With all the people that didn't give up on Ebby, there must have been something quite redeeming and maybe even charming or something about Ebby that people kept reaching out to him. I'm wondering what he was like as a person while he was trying to recover. So I have those two questions.
Tell me a little clearer, will you, right here? Mm-hmm. Tell me a little clearer. I didn't hear what you said.
The first one was if you knew Marty Mann when you were at Yale and in early sobriety. And the other question was, what was Ebby like as a person that people didn't give up on him?
Marty Mann, yes, I worked with Marty Mann a lot, a great deal. And she was the first woman alcoholic to go public about her sobriety. And of course, and in those days, in that period of time, it was a lot of people hated her and all for giving her sobriety, and that she was in AA. But she did the damnedest job that's ever done in educating people about the disease of alcoholism. And Marty, at the international conference in New Orleans in 1980, she came down out of the stands, and we were, some of us were sitting in the middle of the stadium, and she came by and said, "Cersei, I want to tell you goodbye." And then she turned around and said, "And I mean goodbye." And she died a month later. So she knew what she was talking about. And the reason that people kept helping Ebby and trying to help Ebby was, well, a lot of it was because Bill Wilson wanted them to. It was one of the very few things that Bill asked for us to do in AA, except stay sober, you know. But he, because Ebby, in that one thing at one time that he told him when Bill was in the hospital, town hospital, trust God, clean house, and help others. And you know, like he said, Ebby was in the Oxford group. And the Oxford group, as you know, had 4 absolutes. absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute love, absolute... And I asked Bill Wilson one time, why didn't we put some of the absolutes in the AA program? He said, an alcoholic can't absolutely do anything. And I agree. So that's the reason we kept trying to help. And there was a love, there was a something about Abby that attracted you and made you feel like this may be working. No matter how many times you tried it and it didn't work, you still had a feeling that this is going to work. I don't know why, but it does. Who else? Well, I guess I answered all the questions. Come on up, Doc. You have to talk loud. I can't hear good.
Yeah. My name's Jim. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jim.
You mentioned that Bill was in Towns Hospital 40 times, and there's a lady in up in Cobleskill that got sober in New York 50 years ago, and when she was newly sober, Bill said, you're going to speak tonight. And she said, I don't have enough time to speak. And he said, there's a woman patient at Towns Hospital, and they need a woman speaker. And he took her up there, and she worked with Dr. Silkworth whenever a woman patient came into the hospital. She lives in Cobleskill. She told me that Bill had been in there 40 times. The literature says 6 or 8. I don't remember. But she told me 40 times, and they told me in New York, you'll have to get a confirmation. Well, you just given me a confirmation.
Good. Good. You don't want me to reconfirm that, do you? Come on up, honey.
I'm Sarah, I'm an addict.
Talk loud, I can't hear you.
I'm Sarah, I'm an addict.
All right.
I just wanted to ask you if Abby was alive today, what do you think he'd want to say to everybody in this room?
If Abby was alive today, what would he want to say to everyone in this room?
He would want to say, don't be dumb like I was. He would say, listen to those, to people who are sober and the people that make a success out of staying sober. And he would say, God bless every one of you because, and you saved my life. That's what he'd say.
Thanks.
Hi, my name is John.
Hi, John.
I'm an alcoholic. When I was at the Stepping Stones, there was a book I read, Sister Ignatia. We don't hear much about her, but it had a. I loved that book. And I was sitting here thinking, Sister Ignatia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And she had a lot to do with AA, and I always wondered if AA did rub off on her a lot, too, because she wasn't an alcoholic. But when she died, you know, she loved AA. You know, she worked with Dr. Bob a lot, and I think AA got her closer to God also, even though she was a sister. You know, thank you.
Yeah, that's right. She made it possible for alcoholics to sober up. In the hospital there with Dr. Bob. And that's a good thing. You know, another thing I've heard over the years, that we've had some close calls in AA in my experience. Things could have happened in the early stages of AA that would have doomed us forever, such as anonymity and a lot of different things you know about. That if we had done those things, we'd be out of business. Why are we in business? And why are those other, the Washingtonians in 1842 had 300,000 alcoholics sober in their movement. What happened? They went into politics, they went into religion, they went into all kinds of everything else but their primary purpose, and they went out of business. And the same thing with the Oxford group. And the same thing could happen to us. If we forget what our primary purpose is, we'll go out of business. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help somebody else stay sober. Not politics, not religion, not anything that takes us away from our primary purpose. Our primary purpose we must stick with regardless. Always.
Yeah.
My name is Gabe and I'm an alcoholic and addict.
Hi, Gabe.
In step three it says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. How do we know what our will is and how do we turn it over to our higher power?
How do you know when you have a relationship with God? Is that the question?
Now, how do we know our will? Like, you know, in step three it says we have to turn our will over to the care of God. How do we know what our will is and how do we turn it over to Him?
Well, through prayer and meditation. And if you don't get it at first, we'll keep on. Repetition confirms and strengthens habit, and faith comes naturally. But you have to keep on keeping on. I do that even now. I'll be praying to God and thinking about a football game. I don't have a conscious contact with God. I'm thinking about something else, finances or put that have not a damn thing to do with staying sober or living. So I get off the track. How do you get back on it? Staying with it. Repetition. 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 And by the grace of God, it will happen. That you will then know, well, I have a conscious contact with God as I understand Him. And you can develop, no matter what your belief is or how you feel spiritually about it, if we keep on, there will come a time when the sunlight of the Spirit will shine in. And we'll say, and it's a miracle. I see it all the time. People that don't believe in God or people that are not, don't feel like they're in contact with God or have a good contact with Him or what, if they keep on, something happens. Always. If we keep on. Don't give up. Never. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Steve. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Steve.
Thank you very much, both of you. I enjoyed your topics very much. I actually lived in Lubbock for a while. I know it's a dry town, and I'm curious why they have an alcohol clinic in TCU, which is in Lubbock. Did the Baptist movement there have a vested interest in pushing the abstinence of alcohol, or do they have any influence whatsoever in the Lubbock area in the concerning the Alcohol Institute there?
One of the reasons I moved to Lubbock was it's a dry territory. And every damn bootlegger there knew me. And we had a lot of them, too. A lot of them. And, you know, the trouble with the geographical cure and running away is the trouble that when you get wherever you go, there you are. You know, if you leave that guy at home, you'd serve more else, right? It'd be a hell of a lot better. All right.
Yes. Hi, my name is Ron, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. I wanted to know, like, where they say the newcomer is the most important person at the meeting. Where did that come from?
Where did what? Yeah.
The newcomer. He said that they say that the most important person is at the meeting is the newcomer. Where did that come from?
It comes from the fact that we who are sober and enjoying life and know that there's a way out, and we see somebody come in exactly like we were, and you see that, and you know that person can get sober like we are. And if you don't see that, if I don't ever see a new guy or new that comes in, I won't stay sober probably. I have to see somebody that needs help like I did and makes me know that you can do it. And we have to assure that person that they can do it. Look at me if you don't believe it'll work. That's what we do. Our experience, strength, and hope come from our experience in what's happened. And there's never been nobody hopeless and helpless. Everybody can be helped. But that if we don't have new people, if all of AA was like this old guy here, we'd go out of business. We have to have new people, new blood, new people come and see. And if we forget where we came from, we don't give a damn where we're going. You know. Does that answer your question?
We need the newcomer to survive.
Right. Like that little kid asked his mother, why do we say, and like in the Lord's Prayer, give us this day our daily bread? And she said, shut up and sit down. It comes fresh that way. And it comes fresh by having new people. If we had old guys like us around all the time, we would get tired of each other. We see new people come in. There is something that I want to see happen. I want to see that person get well. And what else? Anybody else? Well, I'm sure glad we answered all your questions. Keep coming back. It works.
We got one question. One more guy.
Okay. All right.
For both Mally and Cersei, both of you have many years clean. Do you still have a desire to use at any time?
I don't. He wanted to know if we have a desire to use at any time. He's talking about drinking and using, I suppose.
When I first got sober, it crossed my mind a lot of times. I wish I could take a drink. You know, I wish I could join the party in drinking. But I know I can't. And besides that, the thing that saved me was I had to make a commitment to God every morning that I won't take a drink today. So I don't give a damn what happens. I ain't going to drink today. I know that. And I have to have some way of knowing whether I'm going to drink or not. And the only way I know is a commitment to God as I understand Him, just for 24 hours, just a day, I won't drink. So, yes, you think about it, and you think about these different things, but you, if you've made that commitment, you forget it. You can't even think about it. That's what happened to me, because I made a commitment. So if it comes up, forget it, because you can't drink. You made a commitment to God. That saved my life. A way not to drink on a daily basis, 24 hours at a time.
I can honestly say that my desire to drink was taken away, and I haven't had any. I have other desires, but age has taken care of those.